Welcome, everybody, to In the Know with Kat Bobineau. Today, my extra special guest is Jordan Foreman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
And how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a busy day, but I'm feeling great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Same thing, you know, busy, but I'm doing well.
Good.
Mm-hmm. So, how are things in the world of astrophysicists?
I guess with me specifically, since the last time I was on here, I graduated with my bachelor's degree in science in astrophysics and astronomy. So I'm really happy about that. It's been a long time coming. I'm very relieved. Mm-hmm. And then what else? I was out in Germany this past summer working for DESI as an intern. And then at this point in time, taking like a little bit of a 2-month break. I'm putting quotes on break because I'm also like hosting the Black in STEM celebration at Florida Tech, and I'm trying to make sure that everything actually goes as planned. And then a couple weeks after that, in mid-March, I have a contract lined up with Goddard Space Flight Center up in Maryland. So
okay.
Yeah, so I'll be up there for like 5.5 months, and then from there, I'm planning to try to jump into a PhD program in physics.
Wow. In physics, huh? Why physics?
Yeah. I want to give myself the opportunity to kind of branch out and also to be a more well-rounded and well-informed and well-equipped astrophysicist. And I feel like doing a PhD in physics rather than just astronomy, which was kind of like, that was going to be like my comfortable route, would allow me to be more well-equipped to actually be able to explain the cosmos thoroughly, like how I want to be able to.
Okay. So, I mean, that's a lot in and of itself. What made you even go down this route?
So, yeah, it's kind of a weird story because so I've always loved science and I've always had a love for space and stuff, honestly, even like as a child. And this is honestly because my grandmother planted a lot of the seeds early on for my love of science. She took me to like the Natural History Museum. She took me to like the Space Museum out in D.C. She took me to lots of museums and lots of like hands-on activities and things that got me really excited about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing, but then, you know, life happens. You're like, oh, well, maybe I should do something more practical or, you know, and once I got to high school, I actually got really into theater and I like, that was what I was known for in high school, was being in all the musicals and all the plays and performing and stuff and singing and doing whatever. And I was this close to going to art school.
Oh, wow.
This close.
Okay.
Yeah, like I really had a little fork in the road. I had art schools begging me to apply out in New York. And then I was like, I should just go do this because, you know, this is what makes me happy. Like, it's a good time. I enjoy it. And then I was talking to my mom and she was like, but also, you also always liked space. Maybe you should give it a shot. And I took physics in high school, noticed that I did pretty well. And I also thought it was super interesting. So I was like, I'll give it a shot. You know, why not? It was hard. It was really hard.
Yes. As a biology major who was forced to take physics, it was not my favorite class.
I've noticed.
For someone to major in it, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's crazy because I've noticed that people tend to either, like, they either are good at physics or they're good at mm-hmm. chemistry. I can't stand chemistry personally. but physics has always been, I've always honestly really liked it because it gave me like concrete explanations to all mm-hmm. of the phenomena that I saw around me. So.
Wow. That's amazing. I'm not good at either one, physics or chemistry. You give me biology, you know, make me learn just, you know, the names and subjects of stuff. I can do that. I can regurgitate that. Putting letters into numbers and having to figure that out is not my strong suit.
It's a lot, and I'm gonna be honest, it wasn't my strong suit. It wasn't my strong suit in the beginning either. I really, really struggled, especially for the first couple of years of undergrad, because this was something I didn't realize until I was already like neck deep in the degree program. But I was experiencing a lot of symptoms of dyscalculia, which is a type of dyslexia, basically, but with numbers specifically. So I would notice, like, I would be studying super, super hard with the GSAs, doing all this extra tutoring, trying to make sure that I understood what was going on. And I would get to a point where conceptually I knew what I was doing. I would do the whole process right for a problem. I was taking differential equations by the time I pieced everything together, but I would, you know, so that's like the second hardest math class at that point. But wow. I was just like, I know what I'm doing, what's going on? Because somehow I would end up like getting the final answer wrong. And with differential equations, it's basically linear algebra. So you work all the way down through the problem. And if you mess up one, it's messing up the rest of your problem all the way at the bottom. And so the GSA would check my work and be like, oh, you had the right process, but oh, you accidentally flipped the plus to a minus here. Or, oh, you accidentally like omitted this one term. It was just almost like my brain was going so fast that my body wouldn't necessarily catch up, and then my hand would just be like skipping on to the next thing. So once I realized like, oh, this is something that like, you know, my brain's just kind of short circuiting a little bit, and it's not that I'm stupid or that I'm not capable of understanding the concepts, it was just that I had to kind of like learn to implement different coping mechanisms to negate and mitigate some of those issues.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot. And that's hard. That's hard. Yeah. You know, and it's one of those things that is kind of like, whew, you're figuring it out in the process of it, you know?
Yeah.
And figuring it out in the process. That's a lot.
It was rough. And of course I realized like it was during COVID as well. So I'm taking this class online and all the shenanigans that were happening in the world during COVID were happening. And I was just like, life is crumbling. What's going on? But I'm honestly really thankful that I didn't realize that this was something that, you know, that I have to deal with or whatever until I was already basically more than halfway through my degree program, because I definitely would have cut myself short and said, oh, I can't do this. Let me just go to art school and do whatever, whatever. I'm not capable of this. Cause I always struggled with math, like up until this point, I really had to work to make it my element, honestly. Yeah. So.
I mean, that's an amazing concept, because there's a lot of people who struggle with math and think that they can't do what you've already accomplished because of it.
Exactly. And that's my thing. Like, I genuinely was like, and I feel like I almost jinxed myself, because back in high school, I was like, I could never have a job that required me to do math for the rest of my life. Oh my gosh, how could anyone do that? Little did I know.
Right.
I would go and get an astrophysics degree. But that's why, like, honestly, I genuinely believe, like, if you put your mind to something and you really put in the work and you put in the effort, you can accomplish anything you set your mind to, genuinely. Because if I, struggling with symptoms of dyscalculia, can get an astrophysics degree, you can do anything you want to do.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, you can. Which is that's such an amazing thing and accomplishment that you were able to do, you know, is look beyond, I don't even want to call it a disability, but like looking beyond the work and saying, okay, this is hard now, but if I focus, I can get it.
Yeah, I had to tell myself I was going to succeed. I had the things. There was no like, oh, I might fail, I don't know. It was like, nope, it's gonna be fine. Even if I didn't feel like it was fine, I was like, it's gonna be fine. So,
and that's cool. And so you credit, you know, your family for opening your mind and your idea to science, even though art was right there.
It's crazy, because I come from a long line of musicians and artists and people who are very artistically inclined. So that was just something that always came very naturally to me anyways. But I definitely, like, math was the one thing that I was like, ooh, cause I loved science. But it was just the math. But at this point in time, it's not even an issue anymore. So, Yeah, I'm very, very thankful. And I'm also thankful for all the people who were there for me as I was going through the process, who were there to support me and help me, you know, give me extra tutoring, help me when I needed the extra help and stuff, because I definitely wouldn't have been able to do it without them either. So like surrounding myself with people who were there to support me and were, you know, invested in me as a person, and they had no obligation to do that.
Right.
But that was really a huge blessing.
Right. And that is definitely a blessing, because not everyone has that village or that mm-hmm. group of people that's like, you know, you could do it. And how can I help you do it? And it's really important to have.
Yeah, I really had to like seek out those people. And there was a lot of hidden gems that I ended up finding that were just really supportive of me. So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's really amazing. So, and I'm gonna go back. So you had this love of science, you had this love of art. What mm-hmm. made it manifest into astronomy or physics and the stars?
I think that outside of the, initial struggles with math, I've always kind of really just on a like core level found that super, super interesting. Even like I remember some of my earliest memories as a toddler, I would just be staring up at space at night. Just once I realized, I was like, oh, like those little dots up in the sky, mm-hmm. those are giant balls of fire. Those are stars. That's crazy. There's more than just the Earth. That's not just a screen. And that just like blew my mind. And I also would like read little books and stuff that would like maybe take you through the solar system and all the different planets and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was just So that was just something that I always had like just a real fascination for. Mm-hmm. Just kind of from the get-go. And like even when I was 4, my mom told me that like one of the first big Christmas presents that I asked for, like a real one. And mm-hmm. I still have it too. Like it still works. I can see the craters on the moon with it. It's great. But yeah, so that's more so the astronomy piece. And then physics, once I realized that like physics helps to like really explain all of the different things that I had questions about when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. It's really weird because I remember when I was younger, I would, you know, hear a car drive by and the horn would be blaring or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it would go meow. And I was like, why is that? Like as a child, I was like, why is that? Like, I know that the actual tune of the horn is not changing. Right. Why is it changing as it drives by? And that was something that I was wondering about for years. And nobody was really able to give me like a concrete answer. And then I was in high school physics and my physics professor explained the Doppler effect to me. And that's mm-hmm. why that is. And then I was like, ah! Wow. Physics just explained this thing I've been wondering about for my entire life. And that's just something small, you know?
Right. And the Doppler effect, I was just going to say, you know, not a lot of people realize that there's a lot of explanations for the things that we hear, we see, we do. Mm-hmm. And the Doppler effect is that one where you're here, yeah. You know, a train going by, and what that does. And it is really, really cool and amazing that you stuck with that, that you were like, oh, okay, I've been asking this question multiple times, multiple people, and a physics teacher taught me that. So this is good. So we do have a comment. Having that STEM circle, i.e. circle of STEM majors who are friends/mentor, it's critical to sticking with it. Thanks for all you do, guys. Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know for myself, I went to an HBCU and, mm-hmm. you know, it was a small HBCU. So we knew everybody in our majors, especially the small people who took the same exact classes as us. And so studying together was really instrumental in learning all those terms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How was it for you? You graduated from Florida Tech.
From Florida Tech, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it, you know, your classmates? Was it your professors, your mentors kind of guided you through?
It was honestly more so like the GSA, like the graduate student assistants, the, you know, the people who were helping the professors who had an obligation to sit there and help me. Because I noticed that I would kind of get stressed out when I was in a group setting and I would be studying with other students and everyone would be picking up and being like, oh yeah, obviously this, that, and the third. And I'd be like, really? So for me, that was kind of stressful and I was already struggling with like feeling inadequate and feeling like, you know, trying not to compare myself to my peers and stuff, because for a lot of them, they're coming into a major and they were already good at math to begin with. It was something that they just always had an affinity to be from the get-go. And I was like picking up the pieces and trying to keep up, you know? So for me, like studying with the GSAs and extra tutors and, you know, sitting down with people who had an obligation to sit with me for hours. Because they were getting paid to be there. That was honestly really instrumental in helping me kind of get through the degree program and get through my own personal, you know, mental blocks about certain things and being able to understand things and not have as much anxiety surrounding all of it. Mm-hmm. So definitely the tutors and a couple of professors here and there too.
Right. Well, that's good. That's good. And yeah. Just making sure that you get that along the way is super important. So we got another comment. A child's mind seems to be that of a natural scientist because they are so inquisitive and ask why so much. Yes, they do. I'm thankful for people like you to promote STEM and keep kids asking questions into adulthood.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you feel about that? You know, children being naturally inquisitive.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when I like see a child who's like, why is this? Why is that? And they're like asking all these questions about the world and everything. And why is the moon there? I honestly love that. Because I remember being a kid and doing the same thing. And now I'm an adult and I still kind of do the same thing. but now at this point with the internet, I can like Google things and go down my own little rabbit hole and figure out the answers to the random questions I have. But yeah, I definitely think that, you know, asking why and letting your kid like do that and ask those questions and be, you know, having lots of wonder, and allowing them to kind of do that and cultivating that, definitely it is, the makings of a scientist for sure. So,
right. And the bad part about it is, you know, people who get upset when kids are asking questions, you know, and it's like, I don't know, don't ask me, this is not my thing. And it's
right.
And it kind of pushes away from that idea of being a scientist.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm thankful that in my case, like my mom and my grandmother never did that. If my mom didn't have the answer, she genuinely be like, I don't know.
Right.
That's a great question. I actually
say I don't know. Right. But then to go and either Google it or, you know, in today's day and age, we're like, hey, Google, or hey, Siri, and ask the question, you know, to cultivate that mind and say, yes, it's okay.
Absolutely.
Alan, she said she made that comment in reference to asking why the car sound changes as it passes by. She was asking everybody and she finally got the answer. So hopefully your kids will be the same way. Just keep asking until someone answers the question, right? So that's really cool. And I want to get into the first time we were supposed to do a podcast, you were in Germany.
Yes.
So yes, can you tell us what you were doing in Germany?
So yeah, so I had, I was a part of the DESI Summer Student Program. So DESI is one of the European research facilities that has like particle accelerators underground. And so they do just particle accelerator physics, like that's what they do pretty much. And then they also have, they also do like astroparticle physics as well. So they'll work with different telescopes that are usually looking at like gamma rays, because that basically is like particle physics. And so let's see, when I was there, I was working on a project where I was looking at, I was using, okay, let me backtrack just to make sure that we're...
I was gonna say, before you get into that, what is a gamma ray?
Yeah, so I was like, let me backtrack and make sure that we're on the same page. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So when we're talking about gamma rays, so if you think of like all of the wavelengths of light, right? So when we start the super low energy wavelengths, we have radio, then we go to infrared. And so like infrared is like, we can think of like with, you know, infrared goggles. Basically, we can experience that as like our body heat. We emit infrared light. And then we move up from infrared to microwaves, and then to the microwave wavelength. Then after that, it is, I believe it is the visible spectrum. Actually, I think I said that backwards. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm just nodding along because I don't remember. So,
yeah. So it's, I think I actually said that backwards. So then we're at the visible spectrum, which is all of the wavelengths, like all of the colors, everything that we can see with our eyeballs. That's this little tiny piece of the visible spectrum. And then once we get to the higher energy, then we get to UV, which is, you know, the sun emits that, you get sunburns from that. And then moving forward, then after UV, it's X-rays. And then at the very, very high energy spectrum at the end is gamma rays. So, and all throughout the wavelengths of light, that's different energy levels of photons, basically. So a photon is a particle of light.
I don't know. Small, but yeah, you got radio, microwave, infrared, near infrared, visible, ultralighted, X-ray, and gamma.
Yeah. So gamma rays is all the way at the top. And so basically that's the emission type, the emission wavelength that I was looking at. And so I was using the archival data from the HESS telescope, which is the High Energy Stereoscopic System. And it's actually a ground-based telescope, which initially when I heard that, I was like, I thought that was weird because the way our atmosphere is, it basically blocks off the X-rays and the gamma rays. Thank the Lord. We would be toast. But it, like our atmosphere basically like blocks off the X-rays and the gamma rays that come from all of the stars and stuff from outer space. So I was like, how does that work that we have a ground-based telescope that's supposed to be looking at gamma rays and they don't even make it to the ground? And basically, so it's built so that it's almost like it's got these, maybe like five dishes, but the dishes have all these little mirrors. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a camera that's kind of strapped, like propped up in front of the mirrors, right? And so what happens is when you have a gamma ray that comes in from some whatever source, outer space, a star, then it hits our atmosphere and then it breaks down into a particle shower. So then this particle shower keeps traveling down in our atmosphere. And then basically what happens is, and it took me a minute to wrap my head around this when I first learned this. basically what happens is that as the particles are traveling through our atmosphere, they're able to travel faster than the light is able to, because the air, like the atmosphere is a medium that slows the light down just like a fraction more than the
particles from gamma rays.
Yeah. Wow. And so that produces a type of radiation called Cherenkov light or Cherenkov radiation. And it's these blue flashes of light. And so the HESS telescope, it basically takes pictures of that Cherenkov light. And then it reconstructs from the Cherenkov light to the particle shower and then to the original incident gamma ray.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm seeing if I can wrap my brain around what you just said.
Yeah, it took me a minute to, like, when I first I learned that it does eat, I was like, what?
So then let me ask, the telescope, where is it pointing to then? Where is it getting the information? Is it getting it from where the gamma rays break down into particles, or is it pointing closer to the ground once it turns into light?
It's pointing like straight up at the sky.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pointing straight up at the sky. Mm-hmm.
So does the flashes of blue light happen as soon as it disintegrates in when it hits the atmosphere?
I think it kind of depends, because like with each particle, like some of them are gonna travel faster than others because they have different like energies and stuff too. It's a whole thing.
This is why I only took physics once in college, because it's a whole thing.
It's always a whole thing. But some of them are traveling a little quicker, some of them, you know, and then of course there's, you know, all these gamma rays that are constantly coming in all at once. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a lot happening, even though it's not like visible with our eyes.
Okay.
But basically, I'm pretty sure it's like kind of as soon as, like once it kind of hits the atmosphere and it's traveling, yeah. And it finally like picks up the speed where it's just going faster than the light can. Then you get that flash. Then you get that radiation of Cherenkov light.
Interesting. So. Do you see the light?
I remember, the Cherenkov light is like visible. Like if you really, you could see it with your eyes. I don't know. I mean, it's so small because it's coming from a particle and it happens in a fraction of a second. So
right.
I don't even know if it'd be something that would happen that we would be able to comprehend. Could be wrong though.
Right.
But.
I just wonder, you know, if it's kind of like water hitting a hot pan, you know, just a little sizzle, and maybe, you know, one day you're outside and in the dark, because if you're in the city, you're probably not going to see it, but you're like in the woods in the dark and you hear the splashes of blue. Who knows? I don't know. I might be even overthinking it and overdoing it.
It'd be cool. It's a cool
concept, you know, to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So question from the audience, how is that information about the gamma ray / Cherenkov light being used in science?
So specifically in astronomy, the main thing is that we're trying to look at like all of the wavelengths of light and not just visible. So looking across the electromagnetic spectrum, gamma rays included, or all the way at the opposite end with radio, that allows you to be able to see into different aspects of maybe like a galaxy system or a star forming system or a nebula or something that you wouldn't be able to see if you just looked in visible light. So like, for example, you'd be able to see if you looked maybe in gamma rays for rather than, you know, visible light, you'd be able to see maybe like a star forming region or, you know, some place that is very, very high energy, that maybe is clouded by dust in the visible spectrum. So that's really more so like why we look really honestly, like across the electromagnetic spectrum, so that we can get a full bodied understanding of what's happening at whatever we're looking at.
So then is it a way of helping map the solar system?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely can help with that. It can help definitely with mapping the solar system. It can, or just with the galaxies and the universe around us, honestly. More so things that are outside of our solar system. So within our galaxy, we're right on the edge of it, and beyond.
Okay. No, it's good. So it makes me think of the James Webb telescope and all the images that we're getting from there, you know.
Yeah.
I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, but where the James Webb Telescope is pointing and the images they're getting is something that you guys kind of already knew, right? Because of the science behind the ray, all the spectrum and all the, right? So like gamma ray could be telling you there's a star system a million light years away. Now the James Webb Telescope is solidifying
that. Yeah, definitely. It's definitely like going to be able to bring some clarity as far as like maybe things that we had, like, we're pretty sure this is what it is or whatever, but we're not quite sure. And then also, I think that the James Webb Telescope, you know, with how deep it's able to look into the universe and stuff, we're able to look even farther than what we've been able to up until this point. So we'll be able to discover new things that we maybe didn't know before.
Okay. So is that the type of research you would like to get into, the things that the James Webb is sending us, or what type of research would you like to continue looking into?
So, so far I have the most experience studying supermassive black holes and active galactic nuclei, which an active galactic nucleus is a supermassive black hole that's located at the center of a galaxy. And basically it's active, right? So it's going to kind of be pulling in some matter. And with that, that forms kind of an accretion disk of all this plasma and matter that it's kind of circling around it and gradually pulling in. And in that process, basically what can happen is the black holes can produce jets of plasma and radiation that it shoots out of both sides. And so that those jets emit across the electromagnetic spectrum, so across all wavelengths, and we're able to study those and, you know, potentially figure out some things about the black holes or even how the jets are produced in the first place. Because to my knowledge, to this point, I don't think that we have a solid answer for that yet.
Well, let's break that down. What is a black hole?
Oh man. So, so a black hole basically, is formed after the death of a massive star. So you have a massive star of some sort. And basically as it's coming to the end of its life, normally it would be creating nuclear fusion in its core, but, it gets to a point where it runs out of material to do that. So it'll kind of go all the way down the periodic table up until it gets to iron, and then it stops because it can't do anything else with iron. And then all of the pressure that was keeping the star, you know, that was pushing out, keeping the star intact. And then there's gravity that's also pushing inward, right? Mm-hmm. And so when that nuclear fusion in the core stops, there's no more pressure. So then the gravity collapses it all in. And depending on the mass of the star, basically it can either go supernova and then turn into, I think, a neutron star, I think, something along those lines.
A dwarf star or something.
Yeah, a dwarf star, something along those lines. And then, or it can turn into a black hole. And so basically what happens is because the star is so dense, it, like, all of that mass starts kind of falling inward. So you have all the mass of the star that is way, way bigger than our own sun, falling into this one little point, this pinpoint spot in space. And so that is what creates that really, really dense space of, you know, gravity, basically. So, and then it just sucks kind of everything in, everything collapses in on itself, and it just creates this really, really dense space, and that's the black hole. And so it's so dense that light can't escape.
Right.
So that's what it is.
Right. So let me see if I can help break it down a wee bit more, which is basically a star more likely bigger than ours, or yes, is bigger than
our
sun.
Very much bigger than ours. Our sun can't turn into a black hole because it's not big enough.
Bam, you just answered the question. Before I even continue, there was a question. Alon's son, Evan, is watching intermittently and wants to know if the sun will die, turn into a black hole, and suck the Earth in.
No,
and she said she's sorry that she was forced to type this.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Our son is way too small. Our son's really, really like regular, very regular tiny star, nothing too special. And it's definitely not big enough to turn into a black hole. So there's no need to worry about that.
Wow. So to put it in perspective, right, the sun, which has planets circling it, is still a small star in comparison to stars outside of the galaxy.
Very small. Honestly, to be honest with you, compared to some stars, our sun is a speck. A grain of sand in comparison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's scary, yet good to know. But yeah, so stars way bigger than our sun are pushing out while gravity's pushing in.
Mm-hmm. So our sun does the same thing. Right.
And the reason it's hot is because of nuclear fission, which is just atoms just fusing, breaking, fusing, breaking, fusing, breaking. That's nuclear fission in a nutshell. Yep. And these ginormous stars, once that fusion and that nuclear fission stops, it just goes into a one little pinpoint pot. And like, if our sun is way small as a speck, you got to imagine the spot that it's sucking into is just and so movies and TV and stuff like that is telling us that when that happens and a black hole is created, things like the Starship Enterprise could be sucked in and disappear, right?
Yeah, that's not true. Because also, this is another misconception with black holes, is that people think that it's like this giant vacuum and it's just anything that's like, I don't know, it could be far away. It's just sucking everything in and everyone's going to die. Mm-hmm. It's not like that at all. You have to be so insanely close to a black hole for it to pull you in. You literally have to be like right on it for it to pull you in. So basically, stars and things are able to orbit around a black hole like it's another star. No problem. Yeah.
So, how long does a black hole last then? Does it last indefinitely, or is there a stopping point to that mass being pulled in?
To my knowledge, and I don't think that we know if there's necessarily an end. I think it's like once it's there, it's just kind of there. And the only time that we get supermassive black holes is when you get smaller black holes combining into bigger ones.
Oh, so they join forces. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. All right. So Lana says she, her and Evan were surprised to hear that the sun is too small.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. And I want to go back because I don't really know astronomy. The only reason I know even of a dwarf star is because I have a book for my kid called ABCs of Space, and that was in there. So that was the only reason I knew even the term of a dwarf star.
Okay.
So,
I mean,
anyone listening, I don't know nothing about astronomy except for what that ABC book has told me.
So our sun's definitely not going to turn into a black hole, but whenever it does die, which I don't think it's going to be anytime soon, we'll be long gone before that happens. It's just going to turn into a white dwarf. So if the Earth does maybe get incinerated by the poof, once it does die, it's not going to go like supernova because it's too small. But it is going to have some kind of, you know, expelling of the outer shell, and then it'll just turn into a white dwarf. And that's just a little white glowing star of kind of the remnants of what was the sun. And it just spins really fast and it's just entirely made out of carbon. And
yeah,
so that's
interesting. Yeah. So when a star like the sun is about to die, right? Mm-hmm. It grows big.
Yeah. So it'll kind of compulse, like, you know, pulse a little bit in and out kind of as it's kind of, I almost say it's almost like convulsing a little bit as it's kind of coming to its end. And then it'll finally, nuclear fusion or fission will stop in the core, and then It'll maybe expel the outer shell and turn into a white dwarf, which, yeah, almost like a diamond in the sky because it's made out of carbon. It's literally just
don't tell diamonds. You're gonna have all these millionaire billionaires gonna go out there and mine it for diamonds.
They can try. They're gonna get burnt up.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So, when that happens, right? Because let's say the sun has all these planets in its orbit, but when it dies, is there still an orbit happening? It's just no heat coming from there, or do the planets just start figuring its own things out and floating off into space?
That's honestly a good question, because part of the reason why the planets are orbiting our sun and stuff is because of the mass that the sun has. So it has a certain gravitational pull because of its mass, because of its size, that's keeping all of the planets, kind of in the vicinity and orbiting around it. But I don't know if, once it does turn into a white dwarf and it is smaller, if that would be something that, maybe it wouldn't have as strong as a gravitational pull. Maybe Pluto would just be launched off to the left. I don't know. That's a good question.
Pluto already been demoted. Now
I know.
Now it might just be gone forever.
But yeah, I don't know. And then I also don't know if maybe that first kind of, expelling the shell would maybe... I'm sure that would affect definitely the planets that are orbiting it or, surrounding, because it would hit them eventually, I would assume. So I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, it might destroy the first one, which I don't remember is what? Is that Mercury?
Yeah.
Is that the first
planet? And then Venus and Earth and Mars.
Well, I mean, at least there's something still back in the crevices of my brain, because I don't remember... the order of the planets, but okay, that I was a guess. It was a guess, and it was a good guess. So, okay, that's interesting to know. I want to pose that question to anyone listening now or listening later. If you know the answer to that question, what happens to the gravitational pull of a star once it dies? Yeah. I'm going to Google it. I mean, because
I'm about to Google it after this too, because I haven't thought of that. I've just been trying to.
I'm going to Google it after this, though, just to see what Google says. But, I might get the right answer, or I might just get someone throwing some information out there. You just never know with Google. That's the thing. You never know if you're going to get the truth, or you're just going to get some stuff somebody wrote. Their theory, I guess you could say.
True.
Oh, man. So, okay. We talked about that. And this is this is a part of the work you were doing in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, how was it, though? You were doing gamma rays, but how was it?
Just like working.
Being an intern in Germany doing that type of research.
It was a really, really good experience. It was definitely a change of pace for me because it was the first time that I had a work-life balance ever. Undergrad has morphed me into quite the workaholic. And so that was the first time where, over there, it's very important to have a work-life balance. People are very, they respect their free time. Lunch is a sacred hour. Everyone stops at 12 and has like, anywhere from a 30-minute to an hour-long lunch, and the food was delicious and fresh, a lot less processed.
That's a whole nother show.
I know.
You realize when you leave the country, you realize how terrible the food is in America.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it's like you don't realize until you're in the absence of just how processed things are. Don't get me wrong, there were processed foods there. But even the McDonald's tasted better. I was like, wow.
Yes.
So, but yeah, it was a really good experience. I felt like my life there was very conducive to having a balance just in general. At the time while I was out there was a lot of construction going on around the country. And So the main public transportation line was down. And so they were trying to supplement that with like the bus schedule, but the bus was kind of unreliable and it would be packed and it may or may not get to some place on time. And if you missed it, rip. Like, you're gonna be waiting for some undetermined amount of time for the next one. And so it got to a point where, so I was in a cohort of 11 people, I think, in total. And it got to a point where we were like, okay, this is kind of a hot mess. And we talked to the people at Desi, and they were nice enough to give us bikes. So basically, if we wanted to bike to and from, between Desi and our hotel, we could. And it was like a 5.5 mile trip, like one way. And so that was something that I kind of had to get used to. I had it in my brain. I was like, I really want to be able to do this every day because people over there, and especially just generally over in Europe, they bike everywhere. They're very in shape. They walk everywhere. Like, that's just kind of what people do. They're like Olympians. And so that was something that I was just like, I really want to get into it because some of the other students who were European were like dusting me on the bikes. I was like, wow, I'm really out of shape. But I finally got to a point where I got comfortable doing that twice a day, every day, and it I was part of my route was biking through the woods. So I was biking through the woods in Germany, and it was beautiful fresh air, cool in the morning, the mist. It was so beautiful. And the neighborhood that I got to bike through as well was really beautiful. Cobblestone, which wasn't necessarily great for the bike, but houses looked like cute little cottages. It was just really scenic and really peaceful and very, very lovely, and I loved it.
That's amazing. Also, I would not have made it. 5.5 miles one way.
Yeah, it was crazy. The first night that we did it, we had decided to get dinner after work, and we didn't finish dinner until 11 o'clock at night. And
Ooh.
then, so of course it's pitch black outside. We like the part where Desi is kind of almost the German countryside a little bit. So. And then once we got to the part where it was the woods, we were biking like next to the woods. There was no lights. It was so dark, in fact, that I heard my friends talking behind me while we were biking forward, and I'm like,
Can't even add to the conversation, just trying to
literally,
breathe.
yeah. And they were maybe like 5 feet behind me, and I remember turning around and I could not see them at
Wow.
all. It was pitch black. And I could only see my little bike light in front of me and the bike light from the two other friends who were way ahead of me.
No, that, I mean, it sounds terrible, but it also doesn't sound terrible, you know, because I mean, the realistically being in the city and, you know, public transportation and Uber, Lyft, like it's hard. And but yet we should be doing more like that. You know, we should be biking more, walking more, you know, doing that type of stuff.
The thing is, I also noticed that just the infrastructure of the country was built to be conducive to people biking. The curbs are lower. You can roll right up on the curbs without like fighting to get up there or almost falling. And people are also a lot more forgiving when you're on a bike. They don't, speed up and try to hit you or anything.
Right. They're not honking at you to get out the way.
Yeah,
They're
yeah.
letting
So,
you live.
yeah. So I just felt like the culture and even just the infrastructure of the country was very more like much more conducive to, if you wanted to bike or, if you had to walk around and stuff. Because I had to walk around. I think I was literally only in a car twice for the 2 months that I was out there. So,
Was that? And that was probably getting picked up from the airport and going back to the airport.
No, I had to take the bus to and from the
Oh,
The one time I was in a car was when the coordinator of the whole the Desi Summer Student Program took us all out to eat. And then the other time was when I was in a van and we were getting a tour of the Hamburg site of DESE, which is like their main campus. So yeah, that was the other time that I was in a vehicle. But besides that, public transportation and bikes and feet.
Wow. Yeah, I don't. Woo. And the thing is, we need it. Like, it's important. We should be doing that. But also, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, you know? It's I found that, like, even as I've come back home, it's been hard to find a groove again. Because it was just so easy out in Germany. It was like, well, I have to bike to work and everybody else is doing it. And also I get to bike through a scenic route. So sure. And I gradually built up, you know, my endurance and stuff, and my body got used to it. And my calves were insane by the time I got back. My calves were huge. But it was just something that it just gradually became a part of life. And then because, you know, that was like also really great for my mental health as well. So I had the work-life balance. I was basically working out first thing in the morning and at the end of the day, which I noticed also caused me to eat a lot healthier. The food was fresher on top of that. So it was just kind of everything just kind of fell into place. And I've noticed as I've come back to the United States, it's been kind of harder to find that groove again. Things are so spread out. The country's huge. And there's not a lot of walkable places. Like, you have to kind of drive.
Right.
To really get where you need to go, especially like within a timely manner.
Right.
Unless you're in New York or something. So.
Even there, you know, I mean, I would never drive in New York. I've taken the train in New York. I've seen cars. I don't understand cars in New York, though, because it's like you're not going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You have more time just sitting in the street with everybody else in a car than if you just got out and walked.
Exactly. I would never tell anyone, yeah, pick me up in New York. No, I'll just take the train. I will.
Yeah.
All right. So we're winding down, you know, we only got a few more minutes. So last question is going to be, what do you want to do futuristically? I know you talked about a PhD program, but what do you want to do beyond a PhD?
So beyond a PhD, honestly, I would love to become an astronaut. Obviously, I'd still like to be, you know, my plan is to be an astrophysicist in the meantime. But long shot goal, I would love to become an astronaut. I really want to be the first Black woman on the moon. So yeah, that's like my main goal. Honestly, it's kind of crazy because that's a goal that I had like when I was a child. Like, that was like my kid dream, you know, and they're like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? I was like, I want to be an astronaut. And I've just kind of come full circle again. So.
Well, that's amazing. And, you know, I say good luck to all of that. Do you want to go to Mars too, or just the moon?
Just the moon. I feel like Mars is kind of pushing it for me because I would need a foolproof way of getting me back. No one-way trip to Mars, none of that. I couldn't take that. So I'm good. Somebody else can have that one.
I completely understand. As science is right now, that's a one-way trip. And I would not be getting on that.
No, I'm good.
All right. Is there any last thing you want to tell the audience or anyone listening, or any advice that you might have when it comes to going into STEM or going to astrophysics?
Yeah. So I would definitely say just believe in yourself, honestly. The first thing is like, basically, even if you feel like, oh, you know, this is kind of scary, this is out of my comfort zone, I don't think I can do this, I've never been good at this, like, give it a shot and believe in yourself. And also surround yourself with support, because that's a key piece as well. Surround yourself with people who are genuinely going to support you in your dreams and support you with what you want to do. And, you know, that's really going to get you very far. And obviously put in the work, you know, put in the time and the effort and everything. But having that mindset that you can do it and surrounding yourself with people who are also going to say you can do it, that's like super important. I genuinely believe that if you put your mind to it, you can do anything that you set your mind to. Genuinely.
That's amazing. All right. Well, thank you so much. And speaking of that, Alon says she is rooting for you to be an astronaut. Thank you for sharing your time and information today. I want to say thank you for taking the time out. You know, fourth time was a charm to actually get you on the podcast.
I know. Long time coming.
I know. We tried to talk back in the summer, but you know what? Things happen. We pivot. We keep on going.
Yeah.
Thank you to everyone who joined in live, had questions and comments. Really appreciate that. And if you want to support the show, you can buy me a coffee. I am on Buy Me a Coffee. You can just go on there, pay a little something like you were buying coffee, and just support the show. Until next time, thank you, everyone. And I hope you guys have a great Wednesday evening.
Thank you so much.